It was here.
All right. I'm opening a meeting on the House Energy and Environment Committee for Tuesday, April 7th, 2015. Welcome, everyone. So we've got a work session to start out with and then a few public hearings. And it looks like we actually have everybody here, so we're going to go ahead and get started with the work session. So I'll open the work session on House Bill 2559, which has to do with solar access. We had some representatives here. Did you want to testify, or are you just here for questions? Okay. All right. And so why don't we go ahead. Beth, would you give us a reminder of what this bill's about?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2559 was heard in committee on February 12th. The bill would prohibit provisions which prohibit the installation and use of solar panels in a conveyance of fee title to real property or a declaration or bylaws of a planned community or condominium. The bill would allow the owner of record of the property to file a petition to remove such provisions. There is a dash one amendment which clarifies the meaning of owner and unit owner, and there is a minimal fiscal impact with that dash one amendment, no revenue impact.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Beth. Representative Bruton.
Chair Vega-Peterson, I move to adopt the dash one amendments dated 3-23-15.
Rep. Bruton moves to adopt the dash one amendments stated 3-23-15. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Okay. It's posted in OLIS, so everybody can take a look at that if they need to. Just definitions? No? Okay. Is there further discussion? Representative Whitener.
Madam Chair, I will be a no vote on this because your homeowners associations and everything, they set up through laws, they get together, they vote on what they want to do in these communities and everything, and I don't think we should be stepping in the middle of that. And if 80% or 90% of the people say no to, we don't want solar panels on our roof just for aesthetic reasons or whatever purpose reason they have for it, I think they should have the right to be able to do that, and that's why you have a homeowners association, is to enforce those type of issues. So I will be a no on this bill.
Okay, thank you, Representative Wider. Right now, we're just talking about moving the amendment onto the bill.
I got ahead of the game.
Oh yeah, okay, that's okay. All right. Any further discussion on the amendment? Okay, seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Hurd.
This is for the amendment.
For the amendment. For moving the amendment.
Aye.
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Representative Benz.
Aye.
Representative Boone.
Aye.
Representative
Widener. Aye.
Representative Helm.
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Meredith.
Aye.
Chair
Vega-Peterson. Aye. Okay. The ayes have it. That passes. Okay. Representative Rudin.
Chair Vega-Peterson, I move House Bill 2559 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Reardon moves House Bill 2559 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Do I need to repeat myself, Madam Chair?
We'll have it on the record as to the concerns you raised. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I share some of the same concerns as my colleague. HOAs and communities are places where people live because they would like to determine where they live and what the conditions are and so forth. And I really believe that we're going down a slippery slope when we start mandating one type of behavior and saying that that's okay versus another. So I also would have real concerns, frankly, whether this is legally defensible. So if this goes through, we may have the courts tell us whether this is possible to do or not. So we'll find out.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Benz.
Madam Chair, thank you, and I'll be joining those two in their no vote.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hurd?
I will be as well.
Okay, thank you. Is there any further discussion?
Madam Chair,
yes,
I may, maybe we should add another amendment to allow a Winnebago to be parked in the front as well.
All right. Got a solar panel.
If it's got,
as long as it's got a solar panel attached to it.
Representative Hurd?
I thought I'd just comment. I respect the idea that owners sometimes when they buy a home in a subdivision, mostly that has an HOA, you are in a way buying into a contract with your neighbors. My reason for voting yes on this is that there are ways to have solar panels on your home so that almost nobody else in your neighborhood really sees it, and I certainly think that there's flexibility enough to allow folks to have solar panels on their homes and achieve the aesthetic goals of an HOA. The other reason that I'm going to vote yes is because The administration of the CC&Rs of an HOA changes over time, and what you're really ceding away when you join an HOA is somewhat your ability to control the CC&Rs. In other words, your architectural review committee, they can rationally interpret those CC&Rs, or they quite often irrationally interpret the CC&R. So I think this gives some clear direction to Homeowners Association that we, as a matter of state policy, this is a good thing. Would allow some flexibility, I think, on where those solar panels are placed. And I think that probably, in my mind, meets some of the concerns about the contractual component of Homeowners Associations that the folks that are voting no may be concerned about.
Okay, thank you, Representative Helm. Any further discussion? Okay, thank you. Can you call the roll, please?
Representative Hurd.
No.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Benz.
No.
Representative Boone.
Aye.
Representative Widener.
No.
Representative Helm.
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson.
No.
Vice Chair Reardon.
Aye.
Chair Vega Peterson.
Aye. Okay, the motion passes. All right, and Representative Greenwick, would you like to carry this bill? We'll have Representative Greenwick do that. Thank you very much. All right, with that, I'm going to go ahead and close the work session on House Bill 2559 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3398. And Beth, can you provide the committee with a brief summary of the bill? And Representative Nathanson, if you want to come on up.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3398 would authorize an ocean power district to be organized to permit and regulate and build and maintain infrastructure for ocean renewable energy facilities. At this point, we don't have a revenue or fiscal impact statement on the bill.
Okay, wonderful. Welcome, Representative. Let's go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, representative from District 13. As Oregon moves away from oil and coal and toward renewable sources of energy, it's noticeable that we have a significant amount of infrastructure, regulation, and legislation for wind energy, hydroelectric energy, and solar energy. When it comes to ocean-based energy sources, however, like wave and offshore wind, there's little organizational structure in place. The objective of this bill is to encourage development of ocean-based energy to help a new industry by setting up an easier regulatory framework and to overcome a near insurmountable financial burden. Whether it's wave or offshore wind, the energy created has to get from the source to shore. Building that connection is costly. This bill allows public buying authority to help facilitate it, to help facilitate related infrastructure needs. Introduced in 2013, Senate Bill 354 had a similar objective: lay the legal and organizational groundwork for public infrastructure projects to encourage and assist private investment in alternative energy sources. Instead of sending money directly to projects as an outright grant, invest public resources. Oregonians will benefit from ocean energy projects. Most of those projects, if they are well regulated and have access to public investment. Since 2013, the Oregon Department of Energy completed a study on marine transmission in Oregon. Included in the findings and recommendations is this. Number one, start a dialogue with potential marine transmission owner-operators and project developers to give us, quote, a better understanding of building blocks to marine transmission development. Number three, investigate expansion of state programs and financial incentives. It goes on later in the report to say, quote, candidates for transmission ownership and financing structures do not neatly align. A case can be made for public investment where the risks and scale of traditional investment do not match the opportunity. But what is the project that public investment should support? End quote. So what better investment should be supported than a public project to build public infrastructure to support an alternative energy industry that aligns clearly with Oregon public policy and to support a potential source of revenue, for example, to help fund schools or to fund community projects along the coast? This bill would move us a big step forward to get that ball rolling. To support transportation, the public invests heavily in highways. Trucks and automobiles travel on that publicly funded infrastructure. Likewise, the state could help the nascent ocean energy industry with infrastructure to get power to shore. A public investment in under-ocean highway, and at the time when the industry is on its feet, the state's investment could become a revenue source for education or coastal communities. House Bill 3398 begins the path of providing organized and effective regulation of ocean energy projects along the coast. The legislation establishes a mechanism for the Division of State Lands Director to create an ocean power district in Oregon's territorial sea after recommendation from an Ocean Power District Advisory Council that would be convened by DSL. The Ocean Power District would be pre-approved for installation of ocean-borne power-generating devices. The Ocean Power District would be authorized to request bonding authority to build infrastructure to get power to the grid. And it would be responsible for citing appropriate requirements, terms, conditions, and fees. This bill does not initiate any single project. Its purpose is to establish a framework for the future, for future projects, if and when the time is ready. It is simply enabling legislation to set the stage for the future. Oregon has supported past efforts to develop ocean energy resources. As the R&D in ocean energy begins to blossom, the state should be prepared to assume the necessary regulatory and financial roles to ensure that Oregonians are protected and are set to reap the benefits as well. Oregon could be the ocean energy R&D capital of the country, but to take the lead, it needs another kind of capital. It needs money to prime the pump. We could be supporting homegrown technology. The threshold needs to be high enough to attract competent proposals, but not so high that it stifles innovation and new players. Ocean energy projects can be viewed as a new category of infrastructure projects. We want to encourage the activity, allow it, regulate it, and by setting up a streamlined and locally led regulatory framework, get public benefit for having added value. We make the opportunity and we provide public investment. Public financing for ocean energy is an investment in infrastructure, just as we make public investments in transportation infrastructure. A streamlined, locally led regulatory framework, public oversight and accountability, real assistance for alternative forms of renewable energy, and a potential revenue source for local communities. I hope you'll support this bill and help move this possibility forward. Thank you.
Okay, Representative, questions? Representative Booth.
Yeah, thank you, Rep. Nancy. Actually, I thought you weren't going to do this bill at first, so it's kind of caught me by surprise today. But I'm looking at it, and you know, definition of it's adding this as a district to existing districts in the law, and I'm just wondering, you know, usually the districts pay for something specific but related to what they do, and I'm just wondering, was there any thought about instead of just collecting money from some source and giving it to some other use, was there any idea of a nexus, say that the money would go toward transmission or something like that?
Madam Chair and Representative Boone, I think that's a more complicated discussion. It in part depends on, is it revenue that's going to offset costs or revenue that's over and above costs, and then who gets the additional revenue? For example, there are revenue sources that are available to the state school fund, revenue sources that are available to help pay for other sorts of programs that the state runs. It also would be important to make sure that there's, through fees or some other mechanism, ample revenue to run the district, to provide the public oversight and perhaps a mitigation or risk fund for the potential of, as I believe you and some other members of similar committees have pointed out, sometimes you need to deal with abandoned and structures that are left remaining in the ocean, just like sometimes you have to deal with abandoned infrastructure in other places. So that would all need to be discussed. This is merely the legislation that would set up that discussion.
Follow up. Well, we did pass a law, it's either last session or the one before, about abandoned structures.
Right.
So that's already taken care of with the device developers. They have to bond for that. So that's a done deal. I guess I'm confused as to how it would work. How does it work, this district?
Madam Chair and Representative Boone, there are others who know the legal mechanisms for how it works, what this is. So I am not prepared to answer legal questions, but in its simplest form, this would be like a siting authority. It would have regulatory and fee assessment powers, and more importantly, I believe, to encourage this young industry and help it develop on the Oregon coast, it would have the authority to request bonding to help build infrastructure for the industry. I think that's a key component.
I'm guessing this is going to be a bigger discussion, too, but because I think this only applies, and it can only apply as far as we're related to it, is the territorial sea, which is 3 miles out. And most of the ocean energy projects would be a little further out, and that's federal waters. And there's a myriad of regulating agencies and whatever. But we can talk offline on that, but thank you.
That's correct, yes.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Representative, for being here. Can you define the boundaries of what an ocean or what a district would be? Could we have multiple districts up and down the coast? Is that something that's in play here, I guess, or potentially?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, potentially there could be more than one district. State lands would be essential in making that determination.
I'm curious about the selection of DSL as kind of the overseeing agency. For some of us in rural Oregon, they're not an agency that we have warm fuzzies about. How do you think the coastal community would adapt to giving DSL the jurisdiction to be involved in actually levying some? In Section 7, we talk about an ocean power district may assess, levy, and collect a tax upon the personal property and real property within the district. Do you think that's the best agency to manage this? And I guess my follow-up would be, if there's a tax being levied against properties along the coast, but the potential benefits of, let's just say, if we were able to actually extract some power, would be have a regional benefit, but yet the coastal communities will be those who will be saddled with the cost of paying for that infrastructure. Is that something you've calculated into your vision as well?
Madam Chair and Representative Johnson, there's nothing envisioned here about taxing local communities. If anything, it would be the reverse. Local communities could benefit from any revenue, future revenue that might be generated by such a district. For example, if a district is created and the public has invested in a cable to get power to shore, and in the future, after the industry is on its feet, once it's viable, economically viable, just like electric transmission is a long-standing viable industry, but when it was first developed, it wasn't. It takes a little while for an industry to mature. Once it's mature, if there are fees that are being generated, the idea is the district could be constructed so that revenue that's generated could go to, for example, a state school fund, or it could go to coastal communities. Some of it could go to a coastal mitigation fund to pay for either improvements or to mitigate some sort of environmental or other damages that were caused by that or some other activity on the coast. So the idea is that it would be a revenue generator but not a tax on a local community. It's really the reverse. The intent is to benefit local communities. With regard to selecting DSL, it has to do with where authority is at the present time. I understand there are concerns in other parts of the state, but it seemed to be the most logical when we're dealing with the coast and the ocean, the Oregon's offshore ocean.
I had a question about just the when you're talking about taxes and taxes that might be levied against these districts. There's reference to the counties, and I'm not sure if that's how it would work with, since you're talking about sea, territorial sea land, how that would work with which counties that, to which it would be assigned and who would be responsible for that. Has that been talked about?
Madam Chair, yes. Some of this is written because of the research that was done. Looking at how the regulatory authority would work and who's legally responsible or who would benefit. Yes, there has been some discussion. I guess I want to very readily admit to you that this, while it's a sort of a new idea, I first started proposing this kind of idea a couple of years ago. I think it's really important for Oregon to be at the forefront of this. I think Oregon should be encouraging this kind of industry. As I said, and I wholeheartedly believe, Oregon could be the R&D ocean energy capital of the country. And I think we should be. But to do that, we're going to have to take a couple of, we should take a couple of bold new steps and not just hope that the private sector is able to come up with the funding for these kinds of projects. And I believe that the kind of funding that's the smartest is not those that are a direct grant that may or may not pan out, but actually public investment is something that then the public will accrue benefits in the future. And that's the purpose of this bill.
Representative Reardon? No. Representative Wideham, did you have a question? No. Any others? Okay. Thank you so much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Looks like we have one person to sign up, Jason Bush. If there's anyone else who would like to testify on this bill, you can go ahead and come up now, too.
Good afternoon. Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee. My name is Jason Bush. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Wave Energy Trust. We're a 501c6 economic development organization funded through the Oregon Innovation Council to promote responsible development of ocean energy. I had the chance to speak with Representative Nathanson last week about this bill. I hope that you can see why I would be supportive of some of the things she was saying, talking about the support of this industry and the difficulties that we face as we come on as a new industry. I also discussed several key issues in this bill that will need to be addressed before it's able to move forward. There is an existing regulatory structure for ocean energy that we've worked on for several years, primarily the Territorial Sea Plan, the Ocean Management Plan, the host of regulations that the various agencies have adopted for this industry to address the development of this new industry. Whatever we do with this bill that facilitates the development of ocean energy will need to dovetail with that existing structure, or it will require some changes. I think that will take some time, and I'm agreed to work with her over time to look at this and see how we can move something forward. I think that the idea of empowering local communities to own their own generation is a fantastic idea. I think it's the future of energy generation in this country. Diversified sources of energy that are clean, reliable, and one day reasonably priced. I want to work toward that as the executive director of OWET, and I've agreed to work with Representative Nathanson to move this bill in that direction. That's into my comments. Thank you.
Any questions for Jason? Representative Reardon.
I don't have a question. Good to see you again, Jason. I've really supported what you've been doing for as long as I've known you, actually. And could you step back just a few years, and if this organization had, this district had been in place, what might have happened? Where might we be that we aren't now? Because I'm really trying to grapple with the problem we're trying to solve. Is it bringing a number of other agencies together? Is it allowing better investment? What sort of issues are we solving with this?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Reardon, there are a lot of
lot of aspects of that question, and I'm not sure. We'd have to go back several years. First of all, we put a moratorium on ocean energy development back in 2008, while we developed the territorial sea plan. So there were projects that were tracking at the time that ended up not happening. For a variety of reasons, including the fact that really we were not ready to accommodate this new use of the ocean. Moving forward, one of the biggest problems we face is the cost of transmission, bringing power to shore. It's very expensive. It's expensive on shore, and it's more expensive in the ocean. With the caveat that in the ocean you only need to go a few miles to get to your location, whereas terrestrially you may need to build transmission for 20, 30, 40 miles to get to a good renewable energy site for wind or for solar, for example. And so the idea of having any kind of public assistance with the cost of that will be a big deal for the industry. That's why one of the first things we did as an organization was study the grid infrastructure up and down the Oregon coast. We identified, I think, 26 existing substations that have about 450 megawatts of capacity available. And that's one of the reasons why Oregon is teed up to do ocean energy, because of that grid availability. If you can insert some public financing for that transmission component, it will reduce a significant barrier to this industry. We also hope that it will reduce the amount of gear and stuff that's in the water. Perhaps you could have more than one company share the same infrastructure, reducing cost and reducing impact. And I think that benefits everyone. And to the extent that it promotes community engagement in these projects and gives them control and a say in how this develops in their backyard, I think that's a very important key.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So we just formed a couple of these out in my area for other purposes, and of course it requires a lot of work and a vote, board of directors, and convincing the community that they should subject themselves to tax and the authority of the district to tax. Mm-hmm. So there's to create this device for this purpose is interesting, and I was just going through some of the stuff I'd gone through several years ago when I was asked to talk to a group that wanted to do this. I was remembering all of the intricacies. As it turned out, we successfully got it done, but it took an enormous amount of work, and we still just barely won. I think we won by 1% of the vote. Mm-hmm. So is that what you see as the future of this? Because the view I would see of it is you would have a district that's obviously land up a city, maybe perhaps, or I'm not sure what you're thinking, and then something that runs out into the ocean or is in a way to in a position to enter into a contract with the DSL. Is that what you're thinking? Is that what your vision of this is?
Chair Baker Peterson, Representative Bence, I don't know. The concept of the district is a difficult one, especially when you talk about doing something out in the ocean. If we could sort of turn it on its head and think about the district as a power district that has a cable come to shore somewhere along that somewhere on that land, maybe it works that way. The one of the key issues that has been identified with this bill is the idea of the territorial sea plan and the areas appropriate for ocean energy development, I think, is the language it uses. That needs to be significantly clarified, because the territorial sea plan has identified, I think, there are 7 different zones for ocean energy, and none of them say that thou shalt or thou shalt not necessarily. Each one is sort of a balancing test. So there are so many aspects of this that need to be worked out before we can take a definitive position on it.
Follow up. I was just the statute for a special district is pretty clear on how many electors, all the terms to make one of these things work. So all of that is interesting, but at the end of the day, you still have to have some boundaries, and you have to have a bunch of people inside it, and they got to vote, right? So am I right that much?
I think so. Yes.
So that's what the law referenced in the bill suggests.
Yeah.
It's going to be a special district. So just so those of us here know what we're creating, should we pass the bill, that's why I'm asking. It's not your bill, so I don't have to put you really on the spot, but I'm asking if your vision of this is a defined space running partially out in the ocean with a whole bunch of people in it that are going to vote to perhaps tax themselves to raise money to assist in whatever, Is that the concept?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Bentz. I can't speak to that because the district concept is Representative Nathanson's idea. And we've chatted about this a little bit, but I think the concept of the district itself is one of the key issues in this. I'm not sure it's the right mechanism. It may work, but I have not spent a lot of time thinking about the district and the particularities of the district and how it would work.
Thank you. Representative Boone.
Thank you. I'm trying to get my arms around this now, too, and I'm thinking it might be even sort of slightly connected to 2178, which we'll, or 87, which we'll hear in a little bit. But one of the things I was going to ask you, Jason, is how it would dovetail, and maybe you don't know yet, with the territorial seat plan, and or is that, I mean, we wouldn't want to reinvent the wheel on that. I see Paul out there going, but how would it work with what we've already done?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Boone, I don't think it works very well as drafted. I mean, Section 3 specifically states that the districts will be able to permit and regulate ocean energy. That would require a fundamental legislative change in how we do ocean energy. It could be done. I think that it's a much smaller shift to modify that language and continue to rely on the structure that we have already built and integrate the district with the existing structure rather than approaching it this way.
Follow up. That might be, you know, the kinder, gentler action, I suppose, after what we went through on the TSP development. So
I think we're all well aware of the effort that went into creating that, and there's probably limited appetite right now to open that up again.
Oh, yeah. That can of worms is rotten at this point. Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay, thank you very much, Jason. Since there's no one else to testify, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3398 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3478. We have Representative Peluso here to testify. While she's coming up back, could you give us a description of this bill, please?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3478 would phase in a prohibition on the manufacture and sale of personal care products and over-the-counter drugs that contain synthetic plastic microbeads. The bill would make a violation of this an unlawful trade practice. There's no revenue impact, and the fiscal impact statement's not been completed. There are three sets of amendments on OLIS.
Okay, thank you. Representative Peluso, welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Vega Peterson and members of the House Energy and Environment Committee. For the record, my name is Carla Peluso, and I am the representative from House District 50, which includes the city of Gresham and a small part of Southeast Portland. I'm here to speak on behalf of House Bill 3478, which would phase out the production and manufacturing of plastic microbeads in personal care products. Before the concept for House Bill 3478 was brought to my attention, I had never given much thought to those tiny plastic beads that are in everything from body wash to toothpaste. Some popular facial cleaners and other personal care products contain thousands of non-biodegradable microbeads in a single container. These microbeads are small enough to bypass sewer and water treatment filters, have the potential to absorb toxins, and could harm fish and other wildlife. In the weeks leading up to the legislative session, a member of my staff visited the Gresham Wastewater Treatment Plant, who gave their support for the bill. She learned that beyond the positive environmental impact of House Bill 3478, this bill would also prove beneficial for local municipalities as it would make their job easier by eliminating the infiltration of plastic microbeads on the front end, ultimately saving them money and making their job easier. What's more is that there are plenty of natural, safe, and environmentally friendly substitutes for harmful plastic, substitutes that exfoliate similarly to microbeads without harmful environmental side effects. Introducing this legislation is a simple fix with great impact. This bill phases in a prohibition on the manufacturing and sale of personal care products and over-the-counter drugs that contain synthetic plastic microbeads. With full implementation by December 31st, 2019, This time frame ensures manufacturers of all sizes have the time they need to make adjustments and meet all the requirements of the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. Furthermore, this bill was crafted with great care to ensure that small business owners who may sell products with these plastic microbeads would not be the focus of enforcement or face unfair fines as a result of this bill. I support House Bill 3478 because not only is it good for our environment, it will also prove to be cost savings for local government action across the state by eliminating plastic microbeads from our water before they arrive at our water treatment plants. I also want to express my support for the Dash 1, Dash 2, and Dash 4 amendments, which helps to clarify and define the term plastic and personal care product within the bill, as well as ensure the ban is implemented as intended. Finally, I am very grateful that Tori Lindbow, Gresham's watershed manager, is also here today to speak on behalf of House Bill 3478 and how it will help curb the cost for Gresham and other local governments. Thank you, Chair Vega Peterson and members of the committee. I appreciate your time and urge you to support House Bill 3478 with the Dash 1, Dash 2, and Dash 4 amendments.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Peluso? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You got off easy. So we're going to have Josh Bellick and Tori Lindbow come up to testify next.
Chair Vega Peterson and the members of the committee, thanks for having me. My name is Tori Lindbow, and I, as Representative Peluso said, I am work for the City of Gresham. I am the Water Sciences Program Manager there. And on behalf of the citizens of Gresham, I would basically be parroting everything that Representative Peluso just told you about the benefits of this bill, with the one exception that I think this would really, for the citizens of Gresham, really benefit the ratepayers of our city. So I think we do a whole lot with the limited resources we have available, and to ban these microbeads up front, I think, would do a whole lot on the source control side of what we currently have to deal with at that downstream end. So I'm a big proponent as the person that is in charge of making sure that the resources we spend on salmon habitat for the endangered species that live in the city, as well as the other organisms that we are spending our very limited resources on for trying to preserve the habitat for. This will go a long ways in ensuring that we are improving the environmental conditions that we are trying to save these fish that are in. So by removing these microbeads on the front end, by placing a ban, these are not a product that I believe needs to be in the waste stream. And by removing them before they even get to the wastewater treatment plant, if we do not need to invest in high-cost technologies to try to figure out how do we remove these small particles that are attachment sites for PCBs, DDT, any legacy, you know, there are a numerous number of legacy toxins that are out there that love these little attachment sites that become bioaccumulating through the food chain as they are eaten by small little organisms that live in the stream that are what our salmon eat, the symbol of our nation, then goes and feeds on. And we as humans are really, you know, I have to say that endangered species, really why we're trying to save them is because we not only value seeing salmon in our rivers, but at some point we want to have a sustainable fishery that allows us to continue fishing these. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Josh Ballack, testifying in support of House Bill 3478 on behalf of the Personal Care Products Council. Personal Care Products Council is the leading national trade association representing cosmetic and personal care products industry. The council's over 600 members. Companies distribute the vast majority of products marketed in the U.S., such as sunscreen, shampoo, toothpaste, moisturizer, and the myriad of products that we all depend on for day-to-day living. Even though microbeads have an excellent health and safety record, the industry shares a common interest with other stakeholders in protecting the environment. Ahead of legislative proposals, the council members voluntarily committed to discontinue formulating with microbeads in favor of more viable alternatives. In 2014, a wide range of environmental, governmental, and business stakeholders came together in Illinois and negotiated a phase out of the legislation, which passed both houses of legislature unanimously and was signed into law. The Illinois law was accepted by the Council of State Governments Committee on Suggested State Legislation and recently became law in New Jersey, Colorado, and Maine. And this legislation provides an excellent opportunity for Oregon to take action to be consistent with other states on a timely basis. In summary, this is an issue that Personal Care Products Council members brought to our attention through their environmental stewardship and program and public action. As our companies lead in the areas of health and safety and disclosure, we look to be leaders of product stewardship as well. We very, very much appreciate Representative Peluso, her staff, and our many sponsors for being leaders on this issue. There have been some concerns around definitions of the bill, and we're working to find the right language to make sure that that's all taken care of. And on behalf of the Personal Care Products Council, we encourage you to support 3478.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Representative Reardon.
Well, I just wanted to thank Representative Peluso for introducing the bill and also comment on the Gresham Wastewater Treatment Plant. If folks haven't been out there to see that, it's a tremendous example of what can be done through kind of, I think you're a net zero operation in terms of energy efficiency. Yeah. And so taking care of the environment and doing a good job on our energy consumption. So thank you for your work, and then thank you to the industry for cooperating with helping resolve this issue. So good work by all. I hope we can get the amendments in place so we can vote it out of here.
Thank you. Any other questions? No, we have one more. I have a couple questions.
Oh,
yes. So about how many products are there that use these microbeads?
Chair Vega Peterson, I honestly don't know.
Okay. I mean, I haven't heard of these. I think they're a relatively new addition to, you know, soap and all these things.
Chair Vega Peterson, that is my recollection, but I can't give you that answer. I'm sorry.
Okay. And so there's other states you said, Illinois, New Jersey, Colorado, Maine. When are they phasing out? What's their timeline for phasing out the microbeads?
Chair Vega Peterson, I believe it's very similar, the timelines that were set up. So for 2004, so for Illinois, who passed their law in 2014, I believe it's a 2-year and a 3-year. Illinois, I believe, has a two-year sunset New Jersey has a 2-year sunset, and then 3 years for big box stores to get them off their shelves, and 4 years for the small businesses to get them off of their shelves. And we actually modeled it after that piece of legislation.
Okay. And is the industry doing anything voluntarily to, I mean, since there seems to be a trend with the states to prohibit these?
Chair Vega Peterson, as I said in my testimony, it is my understanding that all of our council members actually have voluntarily discontinued these and are phasing them out as we speak.
Okay. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For some reason, I thought there was a federal program that was going to do the same thing. Did I hear that?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Benz, I believe there have been discussions at the federal level, but I don't believe that there has not been any laws or anything that I know of that are happening at the federal level.
And if this bill passes, what is the impact when it comes to the businesses that haven't adopted these rules? Do we have some idea how many folks are going to be impacted by them? We've had discussions in the past years in this committee about trying to know the consequences of our acts before we engage in them. Do we have a clue as to how many groups would be affected by this that haven't already adopted these approaches to manufacture?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Benz, honestly, if anything that I said would be a guess, so I'm happy to look into that and try to get you any information that I can possibly find from my clients.
Where else, rather than put the burden on you, where else would we look? Is there somebody else that provides this data, DEQ, somebody else in the state of Oregon that would have something for us so we don't have to put you through that kind of work?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Bentz, honestly, I don't even know where to start. So why don't I would be happy to at least get started and then be able to kind of go from there. So it wouldn't be a problem at all. I'm happy to get that information for the committee.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions for this panel? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have one more person signed up, Charlie Chivin. Charlie, hello, welcome. Anyone else who would like to testify in this bill can come forward at this time. Oh, Angela, I'm so sorry, Angela. Come on up. You were at the top.
Chair Peterson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Charlie Plyben. I'm the Oregon Policy Manager for Surf Rider Foundation. And I'd like to thank you guys for this opportunity to present some testimony on this bill. Surf Rider Foundation is a grassroots nonprofit environmental organization. We operate through a network of chapters and volunteers here in the state of Oregon. We run lots of different programs and stewardship activities, and plastic pollution rises to the top of one of our concerns as members and volunteers. Whether through the hundreds of beach cleanups that we engage in each year, or through the extensive outreach and education of programs like our Rise Above Plastics initiative, marine debris and plastic pollution tend to be one of the biggest issues that we work on. It's pervasive in our environment, we work on this issue not just from an advocacy level, but from a stewardship level, engaging in activities every single day to help better the Oregon coast and protect our natural resources. We're very supportive of this bill as its intent. However, we do have some finer points here, which some of the amendments are beginning to address that we're a little bit concerned about. I also may be able to offer some answers to some of the questions raised earlier with respect to other pieces of legislation that exist. This has been introduced in about 22 different states. There are companion bills in states that sort of rival each other. There are two pieces of federal legislation that have also been introduced by Representative Pallone. And one of the issues that we have with this current bill and some of the amendments are beginning to address this is how we sort of define plastics and biodegradable. Now, when I was in high school and I was a kid, biodegradable was a pretty simple term. It came from the earth, and it was something that sort of went back into the earth in its natural elements. And today we're starting to define that term a little bit more loosely. And there's problems with that. In fact, the term biodegradable has been abused by marketers investigated by the U.S. Federal Trade Commission for violation of their green guidelines. So we need to take pause when we introduce a piece of legislation and we provide exemptions for biodegradable. And as introduced, this bill originally excluded biodegradable plastics. The term synthetic and biodegradable just don't go together to me. And we see this as a huge industry loophole that absolutely needs to be addressed if we're going to support this bill. Should such amendments be introduced, which either strike biodegradable or better define it, then we'd be happy to help support this, and we think we can help get the committee members and individuals that are currently working on this bill to that point. Biodegradable means one thing in your backyard. It means another thing in an industrial compost facility, and it means another thing in our marine and aquatic environments. And if any of you guys have ever tried to biodegrade one of those little compostable plastic bags in your backyard compost, you'll quickly learn that not all biodegradables are created equally, and they do different things in our environment. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Angela Crowley-Cook, Oregon Environmental Council. I agree with my colleague from Surf Rider. OEC opposes the bill as drafted because of the concerns about biodegradable and how that's defined. We also appreciate, by the way, the earlier testimony about how these plastic beads really accumulate other toxins because of their chemical structure, so they are a big concern. However, even if if amendments are adopted that address the biodegradable concern, OEC would still be neutral on the bill. And the reason that we're not in support of it is because you know, while we really appreciate the efforts and the overall goal of eliminating sources of pollution and plastics, as you heard from Josh earlier, the Personal Care Products Association is already phasing out of the use of microbeads. And so that makes this legislation somewhat unnecessary. The industry is already taking steps towards this. And in fact, recently they announced Johnson & Johnson, among other manufacturers, have already made the commitment to phase out the use of microbeads by the end of 2017, which is actually 2 years earlier than the ban the date proposed in the bill. So I guess from our perspective, we hope to see the legislature move forward on more meaningful toxics legislation like Senate Bill 478, the Toxic Free Kids Act. This is sort of a feel-good bill, but because the industry is already moving that way, it's sort of unnecessary at this point. Thanks.
Questions for this panel? Representative Boone.
Thank you. I just wanted to say welcome, Charlie. I used to see Charlie quite a bit when we were working on OPAC stuff and ocean marine reserves, et cetera. So it's nice to see you here. And you might just think he's a surfer floating out there on his board waiting for a good wave. But while he's doing that, he's doing a little intel, right? You know, a little research. And he's always been one of the first to the head of the line with when there's an issue or a problem, and it's, you know, firsthand experience that really helps us get to the bottom of some of this stuff. So thank you for doing that. Nice to see you too.
Thank you, Representative Boone.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Angela, if this legislature stopped passing feel-good bills, our calendar would be pretty vacant at times. So but I guess I'm confused. We hear from the professionals on the ground out in Gresham saying this stuff is clogging up our facility. If it wasn't in the system, it wouldn't be happening. So why would you oppose something that could provide that kind of relief specifically to a municipality? It's saying this is expensive and it costs our taxpayers money to have to interact with it, and hopes that somehow we'd get the immaculate bill that's perfect. Is that kind of the trade-off here?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Johnson. So OEC opposes the bill in its current form. If the amendments that Charlie talked about are adopted about biodegradable, then we'll be neutral on the bill. And the reason is because if the industry is phasing out in 2017 and this bill's phase out deadline is 2019, I mean, we agree that there's a problem, but this bill doesn't do much to address it.
Any further questions?
Chair Peterson, may I address that?
Oh, yes, go ahead.
So the industry has actually made some fairly narrow commitments as far as what they're phasing out. What they're phasing out is polyethylene and polypropylene. I can list out a number of other plastic products that they have not committed to phasing out. These are difficult things to pronounce and are probably easier to use acronyms. Mm-hmm. Polyethylene terephthalate, mm-hmm. PET, polymethyl methacrylate, PPMA, and nylon are all products that are also used in these as microbeads.
Representative Boone, did you have a question?
Yeah, I do. And a comment just to follow up on what Rep. Johnson was saying and his question to Angela. It just made me think of the quagga and zebra mussels issue. They're a little bigger, but they get caught in the irrigation and pipes and water systems, et cetera, dams. And although they can be removed, but you got to do it by hand, and I'm guessing that's the same as this is. It's an extra effort. The kind of costs they've attached to the quagga and zebra mussels issue is in the hundreds of millions of dollars per year, and so it's pretty nasty. And that's kind of unavoidable if it is avoidable. But if you get them on your boat, for example, and you take them from one water source to another, or they flush them down the toilet somehow. I don't know how you do that, but through a drain or something. But these bead things, you know, and even if they are going to be phased out, if, you know, what Charlie is saying about these other device, or what are they called? A product, I don't know, a little bead.
Chemical, yeah.
Yeah, and maybe there are even more, but if they don't quit using them and they don't quit making them, and if, you know, it's going to be the same kind of thing that's going to cost, as you said, a lot of extra money that really doesn't have to be it is, you know, it's something, if we can hurry it up and encourage them to move on it and add those others. If they're, I don't know, nylon, I don't think biodegrades, but I'm not sure. I'm not a scientist. I don't know.
Depends on who you ask and how we define biodegradable.
Oh, okay. Well, and in my day, and I'm old, I can remember that, when you threw an apple out the window of your car, you weren't littering unless you didn't yell biodegradable before you threw it.
You bother to yell?
Huh?
You yell?
All right. I do it every time.
Any other questions for this panel?
I just throw it.
It's still Madam Chair.
Oh, Representative Weiner.
This is one of the co-sponsors on this bill. I'm sitting here listening to this, and I'm just wondering if maybe these wouldn't be cleaning up the pipes when they're going down the sewer system and acting as an abrasive. And
yeah, exactly.
Actually,
inside of those pipes. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Thank you, Representative Weidner. All right. With that, I'm going to go ahead and close the hearing on House Bill 3478.
Roto-Rooter Amendment.
And open a public hearing on House Bill, this is yours, Representative Boone, 2187.
Other than Rep. Boone saying look out when she's throwing apple cores
that's
at
right.
people.
No, I don't say look out. I say biodegradable.
Yes, Beth, can you please?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2187. Would, as introduced, direct the Department of State Lands to study issues related to the regulation and metering of ocean renewable energy. There is a dash 3 amendment on OLS that replaces the measure. The dash 3 would express the policy position of the state. The regional transmission planning process is conducted for regions that either wholly or partly encompass areas of the state must adequately consider the transmission of electricity from ocean renewable energy. That's generated in Oregon's territorial sea or adjacent federal waters.
Okay, thank you, Representative Boone. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Vega Peterson and Vice Chairs and committee members. I put this bill in a while ago as a placeholder for ocean energy sector in case we needed it. It seems like we always need something. And I've always wanted to gut and stuff my own bill, so that's what this is. We are, you know, it was a pretty broad relating clause, so I asked around if anybody needed it, and Jason responded, and so we developed this this amendment that took care of something. It's just a lot of my bills are housekeeping or anticipating meeting, just like Rep. Nathanson's bill today. And so this was, and I think Beth just read the, it's a pretty simple little amendment here, but I'm gonna let Jason talk about a little bit who has been vetted with. And so anyway, it's something that we are anticipating needing as the ocean energy sector develops, and that's why I'm doing this bill today.
Great. Jason, welcome back.
Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee, long time no see. My name is Jason Bush, Executive Director of the Oregon Wave Energy Trust. I very much appreciate Representative Boone's willingness to sponsor this bill on behalf of the Oregon Wave Energy Trust, OWET. As you can see, it's a little bill. And probably not the most exciting bill you'll deal with this year, but it's rather important to OWET and to the industry. The bill is rather simple. The purpose of this bill is to ensure that regional transmission planning bodies think about ocean energy as they plan the region's long-term transmission system. They don't really do that right now for a couple of reasons. What you have currently is utilities thinking about their transmission needs sort of from their own perspective and primarily emphasizing least cost alternatives. And they may believe that there's no data associated with ocean energy or models that can be used to implement when they're planning. Mm-hmm. And also because they don't have to, quite honestly. They're busy just like all of us, and they're not going to bite off any more in their planning than they absolutely need to. A few years ago, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, passed an order 1000. And I will
start by saying that I am, by the time I finish my testimony today, you'll know what I know about transmission planning. So I'll do my best to answer any questions, but I'm not a transmission specialist. The FERC Order 1000 is in an effort to change the way that the regional transmission bodies think about transmission planning, requiring them to think about coordinating their efforts across jurisdictions and to think about the needs of stakeholders, engage them in the process more. And most importantly, as stated by the FERC order, that the regional transmission bodies will consider the policy priorities, the laws and statutes of any jurisdictions that occur within their planning areas. And that's where House Bill 2187 comes on. If 2187 is passed, it will essentially instruct these regional transmission bodies to think about ocean energy when they're doing their long-range transmission planning. And I'm talking about tomorrow, but we're looking out 20 years. As you probably are well aware, the grid infrastructure is, as it's currently structured, primarily brings generation from the east to the west, like a long extension cord running it out to the coast and then down to Brookings. We have very little generation on the west side. Any new generation has been coming on the east side, whether it's wind farms or new natural gas combined cycle facilities, improved conventional hydro. And ocean energy is just not on their radar screens, but it should be. Because it is coming. It's certainly several years out, but this bill will help ensure that we're thoughtful about the long-range planning and ensure that the regional transmission bodies will think about ocean energy and west side generation as they move forward. I'm happy to answer any questions about it.
Are there any questions?
Thanks. So I appreciate this bill. It's pretty basic. I was just kind of curious how you describe, how you would define what adequately consider the transmission. I mean, what would be adequate, I guess. And it's being that it's the policy of the state of Oregon, is it the Department of Energy that's going to have rulemaking to decide what this is and how to implement this at this point?
Vice Chair Reardon, Representative Holby, this places no requirements on the Department of Oregon Department of Energy. This was between the regional transmission bodies and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. It's relatively loose language. As a lawyer, we love it a little loose. That way you can fight about it a little bit. But adequate in this case means that it should be simple enough for a body to recognize that if they're thinking about transmission on the east side of Oregon, the fact that there was even the word ocean energy on your paper probably is adequate. As you start thinking about things happening closer to the Oregon coast, then adequate takes on a little different definition. This would have to be determined as all of these sort of issues are between the bodies themselves and FERC, which enforces this provision. Order 1000.
No, I was just looking for some more specifics. Evidently, there aren't any.
Rep. Johnson.
At this point. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Representative Boone, thanks for this effort here. It looks good. Can you talk a little bit about your district and how this bill might impact your people on the home front and so forth if it goes through? What sort of positive, tangible, good benefits for them could be found here?
Well, the first thing that comes to my mind is that, and it's always been this way since I started working in here, is the resilience factor in this is we're all planning for, and just spent some time today in two different committees talking about bills that are implementing and or refining the resilience plan. And one of the things that we did today was our Oregon Resilience Plan, which plans for the big Cascadia event, is more for systems and districts and stuff like that. What we did today is as we are adding a human side to that, so the aftermath, the human services side, housing, food, recovery stuff. And one of the main things that we talk about when we talk about resilience is getting our power back on. And in this big event or any big event where the transmission may be compromised, either the lines are down and all the great, they have some great slides, we'll have to get them out before you, where the big transmission lines are completely crumpled. And those are what we rely on right now. They're coming from the east, as Jason said, to the coast. And what we're hoping to do is get some sort of system on the coast end so we can have power up and running when we need it, because rebuilding that transmission line is going to be a long project. Mm. So that's one of the main things. Several different groups have been consulted on this, and I was going to let Jason talk about those other people we vetted this with. But my district, and which is similar to up and down the coast, coastal communities are going to be cut off from a lot of things, power, supplies, everything. Somebody threw an amendment in my bill today in another committee that would allow for heavy haul helicopters to be able to be used, private ones, to transport up to 28,000 pounds, I guess they can carry, of supplies that they can just, they don't need the roads, they won't need, we're going to need boats and air support for getting supplies to these areas. And they will probably be able to lift supplies that will rebuild a more localized transmission service.
Good.
And, sorry, we'll be using ocean energy. Thank you. That was the pregnant pause.
Vice Chair Reardon, if I might add to that, there's clearly an economic development component to this. There have been several instances over the years where fairly major new economic opportunities have presented themselves along the Oregon coast, and there was inadequate power available. The only answer to those were new transmission across the coast range or new generation out on the coast of some form, probably a combined cycle natural gas plant, either which, in the grand scheme of things, really difficult at best. Now, ocean energy is difficult too, but we're moving down that path and have been for several years. Putting generation on the west side of the grid helps address technical issues with balancing that grid, and it alleviates some of the problems that BPA has had in particular, where they've put fairly massive investments into the grid to improve the quality of power, especially as you get further south on the coast. So ocean energy is one of the things, that's one of the reasons why we think about it and why we think it's a good option for the Oregon coast. And if we can build these things here and service them and deploy them, so much the better.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I've been observing as the 500 kilovolt B2H work has been done from southern Idaho up to Hermiston. It's taken about 8 or 9 years, and it'll take another 8 or 9 years. And the planning that goes into it is pretty amazing. The question would be, when one looks at this, how much additional cost is being imposed upon all of those folks that engage in this planning. Did you by any chance ask that question of those who engage in this kind of work? And I know that it's easy to say that if there's something in Eastern Oregon, one doesn't have to really consider the impact that's going to have in Tillamook. But the fact of the matter is, I've noticed that utilities tend to overthink just about everything. And there's good reason for doing that. They're 30-year plans and 50-year plans and 100-year plans. So when you throw something this in front of them, like this in front of them, it's usually licensed to hire all kinds of specialized help to try to guess at all the activities that might happen in Representative Williams District, and then try to bring that into play around a huge table that's already too big to get all the people around. So my question is, any work on cost?
Vice Chair Reardon, Representative Benz, I did not ask about dollars cost with this. When I talked to Northern Tier Transmission Group with PGE, Pacific Corps, Bonneville Power Administration, and others, ORECA, PNGC, that issue just never came up. Certainly, it could be an issue, but they did not raise it.
So this is going to sound harsh, but the way it works, at least from my observation and the limited amount of utility work that I have done, is the utility looks at what is given and then it responds to it, doesn't generally wade in and take a policy position. It simply reacts to that which it must react to, and that ratepayers get to pay. And so I'm just being harsh. So perhaps CUB might be the one to ask. They might have some insight into this. Did you talk to them?
Did you say CUB?
Yeah.
No, I did not talk to CUB.
That anyway, that's when I look at this, it looks to me like a lot of work for lots of folks. I won't say lawyers. I'm going to say engineers. Yeah.
Fair enough.
We may have the opportunity to hear from CUB soon.
Rep. Vega Peterson and Rep. Bentz, we're just kind of beginning this thing. You guys have all that wind now, and we let you have that. So your part's done in that, but we appreciate your counsel, and I do. I'm being serious, because he has been through this between power, water, you name it, and I do appreciate it. But this is more of the 30,000 up view at this point, and just starting this whole process here to get this out there. It's kind of like the territorial sea plan when we started that amendment part. We didn't imagine ocean energy being part of this whole work. How many years ago? 5-6 years ago. I mean, it's more than that, yeah. But it wasn't when that territorial sea plan was developed. It did not anticipate ocean energy for some reason. So, even though there has been ocean and tidal in other areas of the world for a long time, so we're just starting here.
You just, Owner, do you have a question?
I did. Thank you, Vice Chair. So, this bill is really, I think, a first attempt at possibly what Representative Nathanson's bill is. Maybe further down the line would be an outcome of the study that this group would do. I mean, you had mentioned earlier
That's
about potentially how they would work together.
Yeah. Peppered with questions, yeah. Mm-hmm. Some by me.
Yeah.
You know, because I was thinking at the same time. Dangerous to do, as I learned from Rep. Bentz early on.
Just one brief, would you consider just cutting the state in half and just consider, well, you have down any region in the state, would you consider just doing like the left half of the state, pay attention to ocean renewables and not the right half?
Then yeah. You can probably answer it better, but I'm guessing because power is not just all local, but I'm going to let him answer that.
Chair Vega-Peterson, Vice Chair Reardon, the regions that are referred to are not just in Oregon. They cover Columbia Grid, for example, covers Washington and Oregon. These are high-level, long-term transmission planning for the entire region. They're not specific to a project. That's why they're interstate. That's why they're subject to FERC. And that's the focus here is the FERC aspect.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much for coming. And I don't see, we have Barner and Seaman and Jeff Bissonnette signed up, but I don't see them in the audience.
They were here.
Nope.
Gosh.
They just want to make an entrance.
Maybe Barner and Jeff would like to come up and
testify.
Please introduce yourself and whoever would like to go first.
You're good. Thanks.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Varner Seaman. Today, representing Portland General Electric today, testifying in favor of the work that Jason Bush and Representative Boone were just discussing on 2187. As we look at this bill, it's largely directing the groups that are doing long-term transmission planning in the region. As we plan for what the future of the transmission system is going to be, as we've talked about a lot in this committee, we take a pretty long lead view to what the future is going to hold, and people are planning to 40, 50-year horizons out in the future. We don't know today what the technology is going to look like. It does appear that there's some potential promise in ocean energy as we look forward. It's hard to know exactly at what rate that technology develops, but we do think it's appropriate for the state to make a policy position that we should be considering when we're doing that long-term transmission planning, the role of ocean energy. And it simply has the folks who are doing that planning on a regional basis, Northern Tier Transmission Group and Columbia Grid, starting to develop some modeling exercises and some models so that we can start to look at what the potential is, what kind of energy we're going to get out of these resources, what the cost of those resources would be, and what transmission capacity we might need to develop. It doesn't necessarily encumber the existing utilities to have to take particular action. It just starts to take into account that long-term view. So we think that this is an appropriate action. One of the things that our resource planners have identified is that there's a hard time right now figuring out what the modeling tools would be. The industry generally develops best practices for modeling resources, how they fit within the grid, and what the technical requirements are for developing transmission for resources. And we think that it's appropriate for the state to direct those folks to begin that work. Thank you.
Thank you. And Jeff, I'm going to ask you to keep your remarks fairly short. I just looked at the list of folks on the next bill that we're considering. So if you can, short version.
Mr. Vice Chair, that's good because I didn't have very many remarks. Madam Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeff Bissonnette with the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon representing the residential ratepayers. And I just came up. We don't see anything wrong with this concept. We just wanted to note, for the record, one, to raise the question that Representative Hovey raised in terms of, you know, what exactly is adequate, and I think there was discussion about that. And just to note that this bill in our reading didn't sort of predetermine any sort of outcome or pricing or anything like that. And again, not the way we read it, but just wanted to sort of say that for the record if we ever had to come back and reference that. But other than that, bill looks fine to us.
Okay.
Hey, thank you. Happy to answer questions.
Representative Holden.
Just a real quick question. Do you anticipate this being part of your integrated resource plan that you would submit to the PUC to consider this kind of energy in the future?
Chair Vega Peterson, Representative Holvey, we do some scenario planning currently for some ocean energy, and it's my understanding in talking with our resource planners that there's a deficiency of tools to do that. So the answer is yes, we do in the near term do some addressing and looking at costs and how those things would fit in, and we would anticipate having ocean energy part of the planning portfolio as we go forward.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you. Which one is this? 2187?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm closing the hearing on House Bill 2187 and opening a public hearing on House Bill 3415. Beth, could you read the overview?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3415 would impose a moratorium until December 31, 2025 on the use of hydraulic fracturing for exploration and production of oil and natural gas. There is a -1 amendment that's been posted to the list.
Thank you. And let's see. Richard. Or maybe Representative Helms would like to introduce you. I'll get this all rolling for you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Representative Kent Hill from District 34. I'm just sending around an interesting map for you to look at related to this bill. The purpose of this bill is to get ahead of the curve on the question of when and how hydraulic fracking might occur in our state. And before I go too much further, to ensure proper decorum among our committee, there will be no fracking puns. If you would like some, I encourage you to go to YouTube, Saturday Night Live Fracking. There'll be all the puns that you might need there. I discovered that we don't have regulations in place in this state that specifically regulate hydraulic fracking. And I also discovered that we've had a little bit of hydraulic fracking exploration about 10 years ago. That business didn't pan out for the entity exploring. They went bankrupt. But the industry changes fast, and I think, you know, 10, 15 years ago, I don't know that we would have believed that we'd be getting such a substantial amount of our domestic oil from North Dakota. That expansion happened fast, and it's going strong, and I think generally the additional oil resources for our country have been good. However, if the market changes a little bit and comes our way, I'd like our state to be prepared. You can see from the map that our fracking resources are limited essentially to the Willamette Valley and going through part of the west side of southern Oregon toward Coos Bay. So that's the only area of the state that has potential, according to Dogami. My proposal is that we try to get ahead of the curve here by placing a moratorium on hydraulic fracking until, for 10 years, or until we can get rules in place that adequately regulate the process. And as you know, across the country, there have been numerous anecdotal stories and concerns about the impacts of this type of extraction on the water table and on people's personal drinking wells and other types of impacts like seismic activity. And because of that, there's about 23 states that have enacted some sort of regulation on hydraulic fracking. Maryland, New York, and Vermont have banned it altogether. And 20 other states have a regulation. And some of those states are wouldn't what you'd think. You know, states like West Virginia, Wyoming, Ohio, Pennsylvania, New Mexico. States that aren't big on regulation in and of themselves, and states that have a vested interest in having hydraulic fracking work correctly. The other point of view that I'm coming from relates to a couple of other bills that the legislature passed recently. One of them was the ban on leasing for oil and gas exploration off the Oregon coast and in our territorial sea. That bill, House Bill 3613, was passed in 2010. And I think at the time nobody thought that there was going to be any oil leasing out there anyway. We could go ahead and place a ban. And that, again, might be a piece of feel-good legislation. But then shortly thereafter, we had the BP oil spill in the Gulf. So thinking that our methodologies are always going to be safe in the future, I think, is not always prudent. I think we should be checking ourselves continually on that. The other bill that I think plays into the conversation here is Senate Bill 838, and that was passed just in the 2013 session. That bill has to do with Section dredge mining, and for years and years, Oregon and Southern Oregon in particular and Northern California had some small amount of Section dredge mining going on. Some of it, I think, was commercial on a small scale, and other of it was hobbyists. Shortly before this legislation, California banned suction dredge mining. And all of a sudden, all those folks that wanted to participate in that activity came flooding over our southern border into our streams in an unregulated fashion. And before we knew it, there were permits pulled for approximately 1,400 permits for suction dredge mining in a essentially very lightly to unregulated fashion. At that point, the legislature had to play catch-up and try to get ahead of that so that we weren't damaging our streams. Ultimately, that resulted in a moratorium. So this, I think, is a pretty modest proposal. The bill probably needs some work. That you can see that the dash one amendments do what I said initially, which is to make the moratorium flexible. If our state agencies decide to adopt rules within the next 10 years, then great, we'll go by those. If not, the moratorium would last for 10 years. And I wanted to make sure that we weren't, you can see on the map, we have our mist gassed field and then our methane energy project down near Coos Bay. I wanted to make sure that they aren't affected at all. Those operations are working just fine. I don't want them to be impacted by this legislation. Neither do I want the hydrothermal or geothermal exploration that's going on near the Newberry Crater to be caught up in this legislation. So my intention is to have all those activities to be carved out, since there's no indication that they are causing a problem right now. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions for Representative Helm?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So earlier in the week, I had occasion to appear before another committee and talk about the opportunity that exists out across our huge state to mine, and this would be part of that opportunity. And what I did is I pointed out the amount of value that this state is foregoing for reasons unclear to me, and that value would be going to our kids. I would point out that our Constitution requires that 6% of the value of these resources go straight to the school fund, regardless of source. And I was just looking at this article from over in around Pittsburgh. It says, for example, the city of Pittsburgh is banned fracking but has very few locations suitable for drilling. Meanwhile, Allegheny County, which surrounds Pittsburgh, has approved drilling on or under thousands of acres of public land at and around their international airport and county parks in deals that have the potential to bring hundreds of millions of dollars over the next two decades. Drilling could start within the next year, and the county has already received a $46 million signing bonus. It would appear to me that the testing for fracking has been done in places like North Dakota, where they've been doing it now for years. And the issue is, how can this state proceed as expeditiously as possible? So putting in two things in this bill. First, the 10 years seemed odd, so I'm glad to see that you've changed that. But the other is to put LCDC involved. I don't know what they're doing there. I mean, other than slow things down. So perhaps you can share with us why LCDC is in your amendment first, and then I have some other questions if I can ask them.
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Benz, I don't have a specific concept for DLCD, except that, as you know, part of their rules require the agency to inventory natural resources. This could be part of that planning, and I'm just being cautious there. If we were to determine that DLCD doesn't have a meaningful role to play there, I'm happy to peel that out. But my gut, in working in that field for a while, tells me that they might.
My gut would tell me just the opposite. And the reason is that I actually want to see something happen. For years, we've had nothing happen in my part of the world, and I'm not inclined to assist in something that is designed to slow things down when we can do them safely based upon other folks' experience. So let's go to this other concept. We know that we need more money for our schools. That's been clear as a bell. And we have an opportunity now to get that money through this type of activity or other mining. Don't you agree that we should do everything in our power to move with alacrity and at the same time with due care to make sure we do this correctly? So my question is alacrity first and care, of course. But what's your thought?
Mr. Vice Chair, Representative Benz, I think I agree philosophically. This legislation is not a heck no never kind of piece of legislation. what it's intended to do is give us enough time. We don't have regulations that are anywhere close to the best management practices or any other regulatory device that those other states have. We have regulations that address gas drilling, but they don't address things like water quality and the other components that are placed in the ground when the fracking process occurs. So my only one, I would say, at where we are today, I don't see a lot of hydraulic fracking industry knocking on our door. If we were to try to encourage it, I would say that's great, as long as we have health and safety regulations in place that ensure for our citizens that their drinking water and irrigation water, to the extent that they draw it out of the ground, which may be not super significant, is going to be preserved. And you know, about 70% of our state gets part of their drinking water from groundwater sources, and about 25% get them from private wells. So my point is, let's be prudent and get ahead of the rulemaking process. What I'm not proposing here is to spend a lot of money sending Dogami off right now to adopt rules that we may never need. I don't think that that's fiscally responsible either. But if the industry does come knocking, we need a little bit of breathing room to get those rules and best management practices in place so that we can do this activity properly.
So two different oil companies have leased 60,000 acres in Malheur County, and they've initiated well drilling on the Idaho side of the Snake River and are currently producing oil and putting it through a 26-mile pipeline where they're now shipping it out. They anticipate drilling wells in Malheur County within the year. These particular sources were originally for gas, but they discovered condensate and other oil under that area. It's hugely attractive to them because I met with them five or six times as I tried to lease my backyard. So it's been very interesting conversations. They are indicating that although they have no current plans for fracking, they certainly want to be able to do so within the area they've now leased. So I would suggest that they are knocking. They're here. And so my real question is, can we hear from you that we want to move this matter along quickly so that we're ready for them when and if they decide to go to the landowners over there and say, we think there's a wonderful resource under your private land, which we think you should be able to enjoy the money from, along with our schools. So my question is, can we say to Dogami and others, yeah, it's time to move this thing along. Certainly don't take 10 years. That's what I'm really asking you.
Mm-hmm. Vice Chair Reardon and Representative Bass. What I would want to see first, those are individual examples, and I'm given the map. I'm not 100% sure that we're talking about hydraulic fracking activities going on in eastern Oregon. Are they just regular oil wells?
Yes.
The current focus is just on oil and gas. The longer-term focus may well be on fracking because they will have the leases in place, so that would allow them to proceed in that fashion should they choose to do so. The reason I bring it up is because your bill includes all of Oregon. If you wanted to narrow it down dramatically, I would be happy to see that and perhaps have it apply only to the area you're concerned about. And, of course, the rules that are issued will apply statewide, but your bill applies to the entire state. Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair and Representative Bentz, that's certainly a possibility that I don't know that I would be opposed to. As for moving the industry forward, my only concern is, you know, do we have the funds to go ahead and undertake such rulemaking at Dogami right now, amidst all the other funding pressures? I have heard rumor that there may be some industry best management practices in the near future And that's good. To me, that's good news. But we don't know how far off that is. And if those were to be the kind of best management practices and regulations that we could put in place fairly easily and provide the protections that I'm shooting for, I'd be happy to go after that and allow this industry to move forward.
Follow up, Chair.
Follow up, but we're going to wrap it up.
Thank you very much. I simply want to say that I share your concerns about doing everything as safely as we possibly can and getting these rules and regulations right. I simply don't want to delay in getting there.
Okay, thank you, Representative
Helm.
Next, we have a couple people who have traveled more than 100 miles, so I'm going to go ahead and call up Frank Holmes. And it looks like there's a couple other people who are here to testify. Dan Krishner and Greg Peden. Welcome. Please go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Frank Holmes, Madam Chair, Chairman of the Committee, and fellow committee members. My name is Frank Holmes. I'm the Director for the Northwest Region for Western States Petroleum Association. We're the trade association for the petroleum industry on the West Coast. And I have to add that I'm probably one of the few people left in the state of Oregon who has actually been involved in drilling wells in Oregon. And that was with my prior employer, ARC Oil and Gas, and we acquired and developed this field. So I'm very familiar with your rules and regulations, and they are pretty comprehensive. I'm here today to oppose House Bill 3415. Let me begin by saying there appears to be considerable confusion about what the hydraulic fracturing is and what it isn't. There's been a lot of said in the media that these things are causing lots of problems. This is a lot of misinformation, and it's really being generated by folks that want to stop production of domestic oil and gas. In actuality, hydraulic fracturing is a safe, time-tested oil and natural gas well completion technique used for over 60 years. And I know that I've been involved with that activity for more than 30. So discussions of hydraulic fracturing should be driven by factual information and derived from science, along with governmental regulation and oversight to make sure that it's done safely. There are a number of regulations that are in place that control the engineering for these wells, and there's really not that much difference from the drilling of the well, whether it be in the mist field and the regulations that control that, versus a well that is hydraulically completed. And there is really a lot of quotes that I can go through, but in the interest of time, I'll just hit a couple of them. Lisa Jackson, the former Environmental Protection Agency head, quote, hydraulic fracturing has been around for decades, and there's a tremendous amount of misinformation out there about it, a lot of fear that I think is unfounded. And more recently, Sally Jewell, current head of the Interior Department, said, I'm not aware of any proven case where the fracking process itself has affected water quality. And actually, the question that came up a few minutes ago about regulations that are in place, the Department of Interior has already released their comprehensive rules for control of hydraulic fracturing on all of federal lands U.S.-wide, and that's really based on a rule that was developed in California last year. So as far as the analysis and everything that's been done, those rules are out there. The analysis has been done, and a lot of the myths that have been promoted have been disproven. One option that might be out there is to have DOGAMI, who does have regulations in place, review their rules in compare those to those federal rules that came out recently. And if there are gaps in the current rules, those could be incorporated into a rulemaking, and that could be completed fairly quickly. So in closing, I am here opposing HB 3415 as it is now. Thank you.
Thank you.
Right.
Chair Vega Peterson, members of the committee. I am Dan Kirshner, Executive Director of the Northwest Gas Association. The Northwest Gas Association represents the 6 natural gas utilities and 3 natural gas pipelines that serve Idaho, Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia. About 3.5 million residential, commercial, industrial consumers, along with a growing, an already important and growing segment of power generation, helping to maintain our region's low-cost energy advantage. I just wanted to talk a little bit about where we get our gas from. Today, about 99.9% of our gas does not originate here. We get it about 60% of the natural gas we consume in this region comes from Canada, Alberta, and British Columbia. If you're on the I-5 corridor, that's more like 80% from British Columbia. And the rest of it, the other 40% for those three states in that province, come from Colorado, mostly Colorado and Utah, a little bit in Wyoming as well. In Oregon and Washington, there are very small commercially viable reserves. In fact, Representative Benz referenced one of those in Mallard County. There has been some exploration that's gone on down around Coos Bay in 2004, 2005. That was back when the trajectory of natural gas prices was ever upward, and those looked potentially economically viable at that time. The world has changed since then. The entire energy economy has changed, really, in large part because of this technology that we're talking about today. Actually, not just because of this technology we're talking about today, which we've been employing in various forms for more than 6 decades, but because of the combination of 2 decades-long used technologies, including hydraulic fracturing and horizontal directional drilling. So the combination of those 2 technologies is what has unlocked this vast resource, and ironically, I would say in the context of this hearing, made the Oregon reserves that do exist, and any Washington reserves as well, even further out, other than the condensates, natural gas liquids that Representative Benz referenced that make offset the cost of drilling and might make that particular play a little bit more viable. But in that play, it's a conventional production play, not a shale gas play like you've heard in other testimony. Furthermore, these technologies yield real benefits, from the vast energy resources that they've unlocked to the fact that those are domestic energy resources produced right here in North America. Costs have dropped dramatically. In fact, a recent study by Cambridge Energy Research Associates has indicated that because of the fracking revolution, if you will, consumers across North America, and especially in the United States, are experiencing this year $2,000 of additional disposable income just in home heating costs for natural gas. That's pretty dramatic.
Can I ask if you can wrap up your testimony?
Sure.
Thank you.
Sure. I just want to thank Representative Helms for bringing this issue up, because it does address reasonable concerns. It's reasonable to be concerned about protecting our groundwater, the amount of water we use, how we dispose of that water, and ensuring that our airsheds remain clean. But we think that can be addressed through regulations, and if existing regulations are inadequate, they should be improved, and I think we can do that without a moratorium. So thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Greg Peden here this afternoon on behalf of Cascade Natural Gas. Cascade is natural gas provider in central and eastern Oregon, about 100,000 residential customers in this state. These two gentlemen have covered a lot of the same ground that I wanted to cover. We oppose this bill as it's currently written. We certainly would agree that if our current regulations need upgrading, then let's do some rulemaking. Let's do some improvements on that. We don't foresee that as a problem. But I wanted to put a little bit of a more specific point, Oregon point, on the bigger picture around the gas and oil boom in this country and the dynamics of fracking. That boom in the last, say, 10 years, dozen years, perhaps, number one, helped us get out of the Great Recession of the 2008-2009 nationwide. And it created thousands of jobs and billions of dollars in investment. And if you support, let's say, the proposed project down in Representative McEwen's district that will be about a $9 billion investment in Oregon and create thousands of jobs, or you support the potential methanol project up in Representative Witt's district, which is about a $1 billion investment and about 200 permanent jobs and 1,000 construction jobs, or even if you support the proposed propane facility up at the Port of Portland, which is about a $500 million investment. Those are all possible because of the increased capacity of natural gas in this country, and that's all possible because of fracking. So the concept of a ban on such investment and such potential in this state or in this country doesn't make sense to us, and we can't support anything that would hinder that. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? We do have more panels to come up. Representative Helm.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With and any of the three of you think you can answer this, be great. With regard to the federal regulations that are, as I understand it, set to go into effect in about 90 days, maybe less now, if we were to get moving on regulation of hydraulic fracking for our state, could we just borrow those federal regulations and implement them here? Or borrow a percentage
I'll
of them?
I'll try and Dan can follow up. Those regulations went through tremendous public comment and input and review. And like I said, those are based primarily on the California rule that went into effect or went into evaluation through SB 4 in the state of California a year ago. And they've gone through dozens of workshops and input. So those rules have had the analysis done. I would venture to guess from my perspective that having gone through a number of rulemakings, that, yeah, you would look at the current rules that you have in place, and you would look at those rules, see if there's gaps in your rules, and incorporate what you need to fill those gaps.
Chair Vega-Peterson, may I follow up?
Sure.
Just to add to what Mr. Holmes said, there are plenty of examples really right nearby Idaho, because it is now doing commercial production of natural gas, updated its rules just 2 years ago. They are pretty reflective of what you're seeing as state-of-the-art state regulation regimes. British Columbia has been employing a very robust and rigorous regulatory regime on the production that's going on up there. So there are a couple of jurisdictions just right nearby. Colorado, another one, brand new, spanking new, not even 2 years old, that you can look to as examples of regulatory regimes that have already gone through pretty rigorous public input process.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Helms actually asked a question I was going to get into, was regarding the federal rules. Have states actually superseded federal rules, or do they generally determine that those are adequate because of the process that's gone into, you know, putting them together? Conceivably, we don't want 50 different sets of rules out there. We'd like one level playing field if we could, I'm guessing, from the industry perspective.
The federal rules in question at this point are only for federal lands.
Okay.
So that they would apply to federal lands only.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you all very much. Mm-hmm. Your testimony. So next we're going to have some folks come up from the agencies, Richard Riggs, Bob Houston, and Palmer Mason. Welcome. I think this is the first time we've had to come here, so welcome to the Energy and Environment Committee.
Can I go first? Oh, yes. Thank you, Chair Vega-Peterson. I'm Richard Riggs with the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. I'm the manager of the Mineral Land Regulation and Reclamation Program. For the record, Dogami has no position on this bill. I've provided some testimony for you to look at that includes map, I think, that Representative Helm, which we provided to him. Just wanted to clear that up. That was not our resource assessment. That was a resource assessment that was done by the U.S. Geological Service. You've heard a lot of testimony about current operations within Oregon. The mist field has been going on since 1980 up in the northeast or northwest corner of the state. Fracturing technology has been used down by Coos Bay. It was used in 2005 and 2006 for coal bed methane.
For the fracturing material, they used nitrogen gas and sand. So for you who are not scientists, when you take a big breath, 80% of what you breathe in is nitrogen gas. So it's an inert chemical. To date, DeGamy has not received any notice of any impacts from that fracking activity. As part of the activity down in Coos Bay area, we required a lot of monitoring wells. We had samples of domestic well sources. We sampled natural seeps and springs. And in the last 10 years, there's been no complaints, no problems from those sources that we've been sampling. Let's see. I'm just trying to summarize this because you've heard so much testimony already. For drilling operations that propose hydraulic fracturing, DeGamy and the Department of Environmental Quality and other natural resource agencies will work together to ensure the processes are developed in compliance with state law and each agency's regulatory responsibilities are met. And as a state agency, DeGamy has authority for offsite impacts, but really when you get into it, it's the DEQ who has regulation over what is actually injected into the ground itself. So I'll turn it over.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. Like DeGamy, DEQ is taking no position on this bill, but I've been asked to come here today and talk about our regulatory activities relating to fracturing operations. We regulate the water quality under the federally delegated Safe Drinking Water and Clean Water Acts and also through existing state law on groundwater protection. With fracking operations, we are especially concerned about groundwater resources that may potentially exist for drinking water or are currently used for drinking water. Operators have to obtain an underground injection control permit from DEQ before commencing their mining operations. We also address the stormwater management of facilities and as well as the management and disposal of the mining fluids. But I understand, of course, the central issue here today is about the underground injection. And so, as I said, we require a permit. And when we get that permit, we review information on well construction, the subsurface geology, groundwater resources, and the chemical makeup of the fluids to ensure that groundwater will be protected. Other than the coal bed methane operation that Mr. Riggs just described, the only other fracturing-like operation that we have currently permitted in Oregon is the Newberry geothermal operation in Central Oregon. The geothermal industry tends to use water for their fracturing fluid. In the case of Newberry, the depth, the location and geology leave us with the sense that there's no possibility for someone's water supply to be affected. I do not, I'll just maybe if I can jump ahead to some of the questions that were asked. I need to go back and ask our staff how the federal rules might inform what we do. I do not have the answer to that question, nor the Idaho rules or any of the other state that have recently adopted regulations around fracturing. So we can certainly do that. But with that, I'll end my testimony and take any questions.
Chair Peterson, I am Bob Houston with the Oregon Department of Geology. I am the Energy Resources Geologist and the program lead for the oil and gas program and to serve as a technical expert.
Thank you. Any questions, Representative Holby?
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. Are any of you aware of any contamination issues in other states around fracking that would lead you to believe that we should be looking a lot closer at this?
Chair Peterson, Representative Holby, I am not up to speed on contaminant issues at this point in other states.
But we can look into that for you, Representative Chair Peterson and Representative Holby. We can check and see with some of our other states and see if there are issues.
Other questions?
And Madam Chair, Representative Holby, I'll do the same. I'll follow up. I mean, I think basically our staff doesn't see the current fracturing operations like those in the eastern part of the country, but I will follow up on your question.
Okay. Thank you all for being here very much. I think there was a lot of discussion that happened and got some questions and information out ahead of time, but thank you so much for your time. Next, I'm going to go ahead and call up Angela Crowley Cook, Rhett Lawrence, and Ricky Seguin. Is Ricky? Maybe not Ricky. Then, Gary, why don't you go ahead and come up?
Members of the committee, Angela Crowley Cook, Oregon Environmental Council. Thank you for allowing me to testify twice today. I appreciate it. Oregon Environmental Council supports HB 3415 for the moratorium on fracking. And our concerns about fracking are about water quality and also about methane leaks. First of all, fracking, it uses an enormous amount of water. On average, it's over 2 million gallons per well for oil and over 4 million gallons per well for natural gas. And even though some of the water is recycled with up to 600 chemicals that are used, it can often be reused for human consumption or other human purposes. And I'm sure some of you have seen the videos of people lighting their water from their faucet on fire when there's fracking in the area. So there are issues that we're concerned about in terms of contamination. Lastly, I wanted to touch on the methane leaks that can occur with fracking. So during the process of fracking and breaking up the rocks for the drilling, there, studies have found that uncaptured methane can escape in the process, and there have been 40 types of equipment that have been identified as the sources of the escaped methane. Now, of course, methane is a very potent greenhouse gas, over 70 times more powerful over a 20-year time frame than carbon dioxide. So it's a real concern, and as fracking is increasing, we really are concerned about more methane leaking into the atmosphere. And so for these reasons and others in our written testimony, we support the legislation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rhett Lawrence. I'm the Conservation Director for the Oregon Chapter of the Sierra Club. Thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. I also have submitted written testimony, so I'll just hit a couple of the highlights. We do support House Bill 3415 and the Dash 1 Amendment. We agree with much of the testimony you've heard already today and from Angela just now about the, you know, indisputable impacts on surface water, groundwater, human health. And so we would be very concerned if fracking were to begin to occur again in Oregon. As you also have heard, there are no immediate impacts from this bill since there is no current fracking, and as the Dash 1 Amendment clarifies, would not impact the geothermal hydraulic fracturing out at the Newberry Volcano. But what this legislation will do is allow us to take our time in figuring out how to address the known concerns about fracking for oil and gas before they become a problem here. So we strongly support House Bill 3415, urge this committee to do the same, institute, give us some time to figure out what we're going to do about these impacts before they start happening here. So thank you for taking my testimony. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Vega Peterson. My name is, and members of the committee, Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural. I'm going to kind of bounce around through this since most of my comments have already been made. Natural gas production, like any industrial process, does have an environmental impact, and we definitely recognize that. And we think it can be done right, though, and we think the environment can be protected. But we admit, at the beginning of this entire process, there were a lot of entities that ran out, tried things, and there were folks that did not do the right processes, did not drill correctly, did not case their wells correctly. But we think that's changed quite a bit. The industry is changing dramatically every year. The types of materials that they use for drilling changes, the recycling of the water, all of that is changing. The capturing of methane, the identification of methane leaks. Quick side story, Fluor Corporation here makes a camera that you can actually see methane with. And we actually are involved in a field where they use that, and they walk their lines multiple times a day to make sure that there are no methane leaks. So there are technologies and techniques that can be used. As was stated, we buy gas from outside the area. We have our mist fields. Maybe there's less than a percent of natural gas that kind of comes out of that that's native gas. We inject gas back into that. So we buy gas from around the country, as was said, primarily Canada. But we are buying from through states that do use hydraulic fracking. So we have a concern about establishing a moratorium when we're actually going to states that are doing fracking. But most of those states, in fact, I think all of those states have adopted regulations. There was a quick question about federal and state regulation. Most of the states, from what I've read, want to have their own local control over the process. And most of those states, as a result, have adopted regulations. Was mentioned Colorado is probably one of the more recent ones that just adopted some pretty stringent regulations that are now being used as models as people look going forward. So that's kind of one of our reasons for being concerned about a moratorium, because we're actually going out and buying from these other states. If everybody adopts a moratorium, then we're kind of back to high gas prices and a different economy. I would like to also comment that I really appreciate the fact that Representative Helm reached out to us. He asked us about our concerns. He's attempted to address our concerns around mist. We gave him some language, which he put in. Some additional language was put in that it may actually have an impact on mist because it talks about existing wells. We do periodically drill new wells at MIST for injecting gas back into the ground as we continue to expand that storage facility. The storage facility provides us with the ability to serve our customers during the winter because there's not enough pipeline capacity. It also allows electric utilities to store gas there and use it for generating electricity to meet their customer demand. So it's a pretty important asset to us. And I do want to make kind of one other quick comment about kind of the flaming water, and there was a question about have other states looked at these issues. Colorado actually did look at that because in the movie Gasland, the flaming water was coming in Colorado, and I think they found that that was not the result of the drilling. It was the result of the methane that exists in the ground. It's naturally occurring methane that exists in the surface between the well and the surface, and so the person's own well was bringing up that methane gas. It had nothing to do with the fracking. It's my understanding, and I can provide you with some documentation on that if you'd like. Again, happy to work with you. Our preference would be that if you want to adopt regulations, we'd be happy to kind of do that. If I can make one other quick comment, we are working with, and maybe this is something Representative Helm referenced, with a national environmental organization. We've been trying to identify a way of going out to find producers that produce natural gas, which what we think is kind of the state-of-the-art best practices. And so we've actually been working with a national organization to do that. We think we'll have those pulled together. Probably their goal is to have that by maybe the end of this spring. But we're happy to share that with anybody and happy to share that with the state. And we think, again, there are ways to that Oregon could adopt some best practices. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Questions for this panel? Okay, thank you all for your time today and your testimony. With that, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3415. And just a reminder, committee, we have another hearing today, and then, this week on Thursday, and a couple more next week, and then we're going to hit the deadline on the next Tuesday. So we've got a lot of stuff to take care of. So thank you for your attention on all that. And with that, I'm going to close the meeting of the House Energy and Environment Committee.
So are you going to...
The House Energy and Environment Committee.
So... Are you going to...